This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. It's time for another poetry party, folks. A combination of music, poetry, all kinds of stuff. And what better way to start a party out than being maybe a little bit silly? Here's Poetry in Motion, sung by Johnny Tillotson.
Poetry. Poetry in motion. Poetry in motion, walking by my side. Her lovely locomotion keeps my eyes open wide. Poetry in motion, see her gentle sway. A wave out on the ocean could never move that way. I love every movement, and there's nothing I would change. She doesn't need improvement. She's much too nice to rearrange. Poetry in motion, dancing close to me. A flower of devotion, a swaying gracefully. Whoa. I would change. She doesn't need improvement. She's much too nice to rearrange. Poetry in motion, all that I adore. No number nine love potion could make me love her.
Thank you, Johnny Tillotson, for kicking this party off. Up next, Yusuf Komunyakaa reads My Father's Love Letters, followed by Marilyn Hacker reading Clayus, and then I'll play a recording of Anais Nin reading from her diaries about a meeting with Artaud.
My Father's Love Letters. On Fridays, he'd open a can of Jack's after coming home from the mill and asked me to write a letter to my mother, who sent postcards of desert flowers taller than men. He would beg, promising never to beat her again. Somehow, I was happy she had gone, and sometimes wanted to slip in to remind her how Mary Lou Williams' polka dots and moonbeams never made the swelling go down. His carpenter's apron always budged with old nails, a claw hammer looped at his side, and extension cords coiled around his feet. Words rolled from under the pressure of my ballpoint. Love, baby, honey, please. We sat in the quiet brutality of voltage meters and pipe threaders lost between sentences. The gleam of a 5-pound wedge on the concrete floor pulled a sunset through the doorway of his tool shed. I wonder if she laughed and held them over a gas burner. My father could only sign his name, but he'd look at blueprints and say how many bricks formed each wall. This man who stole roses and hyacinth for his yard would stand there with eyes closed and fists balled, laboring over a simple word almost redeemed by what he tried to say.
This is one for my daughter. It's called Clayus, which is, that was the name of Sappho's daughter, and it's also in Sapphic, so that's the only reason for the title. She's 16 and looks like a full-grown woman, teenaged status hinted at by the acne. I remember infancy's gold, unblemished skin. I remember every time I scolded her, slapped her, wished her someone whom she wasn't, and let her know it. Every mother knows she betrays her daughter. Does she? Maybe. She was not the builder of model airplanes. She was not the runner I never could be. She was not the pillager of my bookshelves, Rimbaud or Bronte. She was not the heroine of a novel. She was only 8, with a perfect body caught above the swimming pool, mid-air, leaping into blue water. Snapshot, 1982. Voss, she joined me, Air France, unaccompanied minor. She's the basic human integer, brown-skinned, golden, wingless, but flying. She has breasts and buttocks to keep her earthbound now. She rereads children's books in her loft bed, Little Women, Anne of Green Gables, Robin Hood, and Black Beauty. Dreaming herself back out of adolescence while she talks of cars and her own apartment, 16 is a waiting room, older, younger, anything's better. Every day, a little bit more a grown-up face, not known yet, superimposed on her face as it turns, a sunflower out of childhood, bright and amazing, like one of her lullabies by a poet, ragged, old, incontinent, isolated in a walk-up cluttered with rocks and papers now, a flamboyant balladeer once, cats by the fire in winter, magic cat king purring beside the singer, famine and despair in the cries of scrawny cats on the pavement. Years now since I stroked her and sang that to her. Since her breasts grew, I haven't seen her naked. Infant sweats like lavender water, hers is womanly, pungent. When I was in love with her, with a lover's tendency to mythify the beloved, did I know her better than I do now, when we know our limits? Now she is a traveler like the others, blonde braid, man's hat, jeans and a gray tweed blazer, pushing one old duffel bag on a trolley, free in an airport full of haggard voyagers, coming, going. She stops, sees me, under the sign arrivals, we embrace and heft the old bag up, one strap each on our shoulders.
First, I would like to say that it was not nostalgia which made me edit and publish the diaries. It was not nostalgia for the past, but the knowledge that the people I was writing about are playing a role in our present life. This is true of almost all the ones I mentioned in the first volume: Henry Miller, Lawrence Durrell, Antonin Artaud, and a long list of other personages who are still dynamically influencing our present life. The first one I will read about is Antonin Artaud, because of his influence on the theater, because of his influence in film, because he really perceived in the 30s all the changes that would take place in the cinema and on the theater, and particularly this desire for the loss of distance and objectivity, so that the drama would be something we would become involved in. I'm reading you about a meeting with Artaud at the Sorbonne. It was the schoolroom of the Sorbonne. Alain D and Artaud were sitting at the big desk. Alain D introduced Artaud. The room was crowded. The blackboard made a strange backdrop. People of all ages, followers of Alain D's lectures on new ideas. The light was crude. It made Artaud's eyes shrink into darkness, as they are deep set. This brought into relief the intensity of his gestures. He looked tormented. His hair, rather long, fell at times over his forehead. He has the actor's nimbleness and quickness of gestures. His face is lean, as if ravaged by fevers. His eyes do not seem to see the people. They are the eyes of a visionary. His hands are long and long-fingered. Beside him, Alain D looks earthy, heavy, gray. He sits at the desk, massive, brooding. Artaud steps out on the platform and begins to talk about the theater and the plague. He had asked me to sit in the front row. It seems to me that all he's asking for is intensity, a more heightened form of feeling and living. Is he trying to remind us that it was during the plague that so many marvelous works of art and theater came to be? Because, whipped by the fear of death, man seeks immortality, or to escape, or to surpass himself. But then, imperceptibly almost, he let go of the thread we were following and began to act out, dying by the plague. No one quite knew when it began. To illustrate his conference, he was acting out an agony. La peste in French is so much more terrible than the plague in English. But no word could describe what Artaud acted on the platform of the Sorbonne. He forgot about his conference, the theater, his ideas, Dr. Allendy sitting there, the public, the young students, his wife, professors, and directors. His face was contorted with anguish. One could see the perspiration dampening his hair. His eyes dilated, his muscles became cramped, his fingers struggled to retain their flexibility. He made one feel the parched and burning throat, the pains, the fever, the fire in the guts. He was in agony. He was screaming. He was delirious. He was enacting his own death, his own crucifixion. At first, people gasped, and then they began to laugh. Everyone was laughing. They hissed, and then one by one, they began to leave, noisily, talking, protesting. They banged the doors as they left. The only ones who did not move were Allendy, his wife, de Lalouse, and Marguerite. More protestations, more jeering, but Artaud went on until the last gasp and stayed on the floor. And then when the hall had emptied of all but his small group of friends, he walked straight up to me and asked me to go to the café with him. Everyone else had something to do. We all parted at the door of the Sorbonne, and Artaud and I walked out in a fine mist. We walked and walked through the dark streets. He was hurt, wounded, baffled by the jeering. He spat out his anger. They always want to hear about. They want to hear an objective conference on the theater and the plague, and I want to give them the experience itself, the plague itself, so they will be terrified and awaken. I want to awaken them. They do not realize they are dead. Their death is total, like deafness, blindness. This is agony I portrayed, mine, yes, and everyone who is alive. The mist fell on his face. He pushed his hair away from his forehead. He looked taut and obsessed, but now he spoke quietly. We sat in the coupole, and he forgot the conference. I have never found anyone who felt as I did. I have been an opium addict for 15 years. It was first given to me when I was very young to calm some terrible pains in my head. I feel sometimes that I'm not writing about writing, but describing the struggles with writing, the struggles of birth. He recited poetry. We talked about form, the theater, his work. He grew calm and gentle, and we walked in the rain. For him, the plague was no worse than death by mediocrity, death by commercialism, death by corruption, which surrounded us. He wanted to make people aware that they were dying and to force them into a poetic state. The hostility only proved that you disturbed them, I said. But what a shock to see a sensitive poet confronting the hostile public.
I'm
This is Catherine Hastings, and that was the wonderful Kate Royal singing I Have Dreamt from Wuthering Heights. Before Royal, you heard Yusuf Komunyakaa, Marilyn Hacker, and then Anais Nin reading from her diaries. We are having a poetry party, so up next are John Updike reading Seagulls, Donald Justice reading Psalm and Lament, followed by a recording of Kenneth Rexroth performing The Statue of St. Francis.
A gull, up close, looks surprisingly stuffed. His fluffy chest seems filled with an inexpensive taxidermist's material, rather lumpily inserted. The legs, unbent, are childish crayon strokes, too simple to be workable. And even the feather markings, whose intricate symmetry is the usual glory of birds, are in the gull slovenly, as if God makes too many to make them very well. Are they intelligent? We imagine so because they are ugly. The sardonic one-eyed profile, slightly cross, the narrow ectomorphic head, badly combed, the wide and nervous and well-muscled rump, all suggest desk work, shipping rates by day, Schopenhauer by night, and endless coffee. At that hour on the beach, when the flies begin biting in the renewed coolness, and the backsliding skin of the after surf reflects a pink shimmer before being blotted, the gulls stand around in the dimpled sand like those melancholy European crowds that gather in cobbled public squares in the wake of assassinations and invasions, heads cocked to hear the latest radio reports. It is also this hour when plump young couples walk down to the water, bumping together, and stand thigh deep in the rhythmic glass. Then they walk back toward the car, tugging as if at a secret between them, but which neither quite knows. Walk capricious paths through the scattering gulls, as in some mythologies, beautiful gods stroll unconcerned among our mortal apprehensions.
The clocks are sorry. The clocks are very sad. One stops, one goes on striking the wrong hours. And the grass burns terribly in the sun. The grass turns yellow secretly at the roots. Now suddenly the yard chairs look empty. The sky looks empty. The sky looks vast and empty. Out on Red Road, the traffic continues. Everything continues. Nor does memory sleep. It goes on. Out spring the butterflies of recollection. And I think that for the first time I understand the beautiful, ordinary light of this patio, and even, perhaps, the dark, rich earth of a heart. The bedclothes, they say, had been pulled down. I will not describe it. I do not want to describe it. No, but the sheets were drenched and twisted. They were the very handkerchiefs of grief. Let summer come now, with its schoolboy trumpets and fountains. But the years are gone. The years are finally over. And there is only this long desolation of flower-bordered sidewalks that runs to the corner, turns and goes on, that disappears and goes on into the black oblivion of a neighborhood and a world without billboards or yesterdays. Sometimes a sad moon comes and waters the roof tiles. But the years are gone. There are no more years.
This is the statue of St. Francis. It really happened. They were putting up the statue of St. Francis in front of the Church of St. Francis, in the city of San Francisco, in a little side street just off the avenue where no bird sang. And the sun was coming up on time in its usual fashion, and just beginning to shine on the statue of St. Francis, where no birds sang. And a lot of old Italians were standing all around in the little side street just off the avenue, watching the wily workers who were hoisting up the statue with a chain and a crane and other implements. And a lot of young reporters in button-down clothes were taking down the words of one young priest who was propping up the statue with all his arguments. And all the while no bird sang any St. Francis Passion, and while the lookers kept looking up at St. Francis with his arms outstretched to the birds which weren't there, a very tall and very purely naked young virgin with very long and very straight straw hair and wearing only a very small bird's nest in a very existential place kept passing through the crowd all the while and up and down the steps in front of St. Francis, her eyes downcast all the while and singing to herself.
And here is Philip Levine.
This is called My Father Was Cigarette 12 Years Before the Nazis Could Break His Heart. The year is 1933. I remember the room in which he held a kitchen match and with his thumbnail commanded it to flame. A brown sofa, two easy chairs, one covered with flowers. A black piano no one ever played, half covered by a long fringed ornamental scarf Ray Estrada brought back from Mexico in 1931. How new the world is, you say. In that room, someone is speaking about money, asking why it matters. And my father exhales the blue smoke and says $1 million, even in large bills, would be impossible. He's telling me. Because I see now I'm the one who asked. For I dream of money, always coins and bills that run through my hands, money I find in the corners of unknown rooms or in metal boxes I dig up in the backyard flower beds of houses I've never seen. My father rises now and goes to the closet. It's as though someone were directing a play and my father's part called for him to stand, so that the audience, which must be you, could see him in white shirt, dark trousers, held up by suspenders, a sign of the times, and conclude he is taller than his son will ever be. And as he dips into his jacket, you'll know his role calls for him to exit by the front door, leaving something unfinished, the closet light still on, the cigarette still burning dangerously, a Yiddish paper folded to the right place, so that a photograph of Hindenburg in full military regalia swims up to you out of all the details we lived. I remember the way the match flared blue and yellow in the deepening light of a cool afternoon in early September, and the sound, part iron, part animal, part music, as the air rushed toward it out of my mouth, and his intake of breath through the lucky strike, and the smoke hanging on after the door closed and the play ran out of acts and actors, and the audience, which must be you, grew tired of these lives that finally come to nothing, or no more than the furniture and the cotton drapes left open so the darkening sky can seem to have the last word with half a moon and a showering of fake stars to say what the stars always say about the ordinary. Oh, you're still here, 60 years later. You wonder what became of us, why someone put it in a book and left the book open to a page no one reads. Everything tells you he never came back, though he did before he didn't. Everything suggests It was the year Hitler came to power, the year my grandmother learned to read English novels and fell in love with David Copperfield and Oliver Twist, which she read to me seated on a stool beside my bed until I fell asleep. Everything tells you this is a preface to something important, the Second World War, the news that leaked back from Poland that the villages were gone. The truth is, if there is a truth, I remember the room. I remember the flame, the blue smoke. How bright and slippery were the secret coins. How David Copperfield doubted his own name. How sweet the stars seemed, peeping and blinking. How close the moon. How utterly silent the piano.
Hey, man, what's the matter? What you doing standing up there shaking like that?
Oh, man, I feel real weak in the knees. I'm getting ready to take on a bride.
Oh, you're going to get married?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Well, you got no business shaking at the knees.
Yeah, well, I'm just weak, that's all.
Yeah, well, the boys are going to tell you what to do. Okay. Listen to them.
Don't falter at the altar when you take that great big step. Don't falter at the altar. Just you try and be him. Lift your feet high. Ain't no time to sigh. It's your last free mile. So smile, brother, smile. Don't falter at the altar, 'cause you have no cause to fear. Your father didn't falter, son, that's why you're here. When you take that great big step, don't falter at the altar, 'cause you have no cause to fear.
Your father didn't falter, son, that's why you're here. Well, now, how do you feel now, son?
Well, I feel a little better now, Gab. That was a nice bracer.
A little bracer, huh?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Oh, that's a good deal. I'm glad you feel better.
Feeling fine.
Doggone, you went and faltered anyway.
Sure did.
And that, of course, was the wonderful Cab Calloway performing Don't Falter at the Altar. That's from his Are You Hep to the Jive CD. And before Cab Calloway, you heard Philip Levine read My Father with Cigarette 12 years before the Nazis could break his heart. We are having a poetry party tonight, and that means lots of poetry and a little music thrown in now and then, too. You are listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. This is Catherine Hastings. And over the next 15 minutes or so, I'm going to dedicate the show to one of this year's ultimate poetry parties, Rockpile. I have invited West County poets Michael Rothenberg and Terry Carrion into the studio to talk about this very exciting, multifaceted, and perhaps historical project. I think we'll start with Terry giving us just a general description of what Rockpile is.
Well, Rockpile is a collaborative journey of poetry and music, and it's a collaboration between David Meltzer, poet, musician, jazz writer, essayist, teacher, and much more, and Michael Rothenberg, who's also a songwriter, poet, and editor of Big Bridge Press. David and Michael will journey through 8 cities, which includes L.A., Albuquerque, New Orleans, D.C., New York, Chicago, and St. Louis. and they'll be performing poetry and prose composed while on the road with local musicians and artists in each of these cities. Rockpile is going to serve to educate and preserve as well as to create a history of collaboration. It will help to reinforce the tradition of the troubadour of all generations, central to the cultural upheaval and identity politics that have reawakened poets, artists, musicians, and songwriters in the mid-1960s through the 70s and beyond. The project is going to end in a final multimedia culminating performance in San Francisco.
So, Michael, we got a list of the cities. Where specifically are these events going to be taking place?
Rockpile is going to go for 8 weeks on the road to L.A., the Hammer Museum in L.A., the Outpost Performance Space in Albuquerque. We'll be in the Zeitgeist Multidisciplinary Arts Center in New Orleans. We'll be going on to Busboys and Poets in D.C., the Gershwin Hotel in New York, the Hideout Jazz Club in Chicago, and the Regional Performance Space in St. Louis. This is a 2-month road trip, basically, you know, and we have about a week in each town and stopping in between towns at different places to meet local people.
Well, why don't you give us an idea of who's going to be involved in some of the key cities?
Well, at the Hammer Museum in L.A., we're going to be performing with Johnny Lee Schell, the lead guitar player for Bonnie Raitt's band, and Taj Mahal toured with them for a long time, and Theo Saunders plays with Freddie Hubbard and Carla Bay. When we get to Albuquerque, we'll be with the Thunderbird Poetry Orchestra, which will be a great chaos of glockenspiels and hubcapophones. We'll be in New Orleans. We're really excited about performing with members of the Dirty Dozen Brass Band. In D.C., we'll be working with Burnett Thompson and the New Columbia Orchestra. In New York, Marty Ehrlich will be joining us, the famed multi-reed player. And in Chicago, we'll be there with Dan McNaughton's Spider Trio and Bob Malone Band. And a whole bunch of musicians are going to join us in Chicago as well, in St. Louis with Zimbabwe Nakenya and Dave Black.
I know that since Rockpile was first conceived, it's grown quite a bit. You know, it's expanded to include other things besides the poetry readings and music. Can you give me an idea of what else people can expect?
Well, the original concept of Rockpile was that we were going to be performing with local musicians local to the areas we were going to in these eight major cities. And as we went along and developed the project, we found that there was an interest and need to discuss the concept behind Rockpile to the greats. I'm really looking forward to the symposium in New York at St. Mark's with Amiel Al-Khalei and Murat Nemet-Najat and Wanda Phipps and Robert Priest coming in from Canada, Harris Schiff, and Susie Winson, a whole group of people who are going to be sitting discussing art and activism and the troubadour tradition and censorship and the academy and issues that are current. And it'll be great because none of us have gotten together before like this, and everyone was really excited to do that. In New Orleans, we're going to have a soiree in the French Quarter, which everyone wanted to have a party. So we're going to just have a party in addition to the Zeitgeist performance. And then that doubled up again to a open mic and poetry music jam on the 23rd of October. So we have a whole weekend of events so that it becomes more inclusive, lots of room for people to participate, not just the performance of David myself. In a salon in Santa Fe, nearby to Albuquerque, where people who can get into the program and then come on down to Albuquerque from Santa Fe and have a good time. So it has expanded into an overall discussion and celebration of poetry.
So while you're on the road and all of this exciting stuff is going on, how can people see and hear what's happening and keep track of Rockpile?
If you want to join us on the Rockpile tour, you can join us on the Rockpile blog, which is www.bigbridge.org/rockpile. We'll on that site, you can find out about the musicians, the performances, and where they will be. You can see blog entries from David Meltzer and Terry Carrion and myself. There'll be uploading of performances with these, you know, the big shows. There'll be tapings of interviews that we'll do of each other on the road, tapings of people we're going to meet on the road, taping of the musicians that we're going to work with, interviewing them. And we'll be able, if you're in New York and you want to find out what's going on in Albuquerque, you can just go online and find out and hope, write us a letter or write us a comment, and we can, you'll be part of what's happening, and we'll get this whole communication taking place on the blog about what's going on and what's going to happen, and you can participate in making it happen.
Michael, do you think this kind of thing has happened before? Have there been rock piles in the past?
Well, you know, poets have been reading around the country forever, and musicians have been on the road forever. And I know that poets have been working with musicians in different towns. The thing that's different about this trip is that we are trying to get a national awareness where people in different cities are aware what's going on, and that we're working with these local musicians, and that we're dealing with subjects and that we want to be talked about from place to place. And we want that communication from these different cities to be shared nationally by people around the country. So I think that in some ways, thematically, no, it's never been done before.
So how about giving us a real, you know, strong example of what people might see and hear? You know, like if I were to walk in to the right city at the right time and you and David took the stage, what am I going to hear?
Well, if you come to see us, for instance, in New Orleans, David and I are both going to be performing with members of the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, and we will kind of have a rehearsal earlier in the week. We'll be working out of materials that we have composed on the road, as well as set pieces that we've developed previously. We really don't know exactly yet which piece we will work with in New Orleans or any city, so it'll be a bit of a surprise. We don't know how the musicians are going to interact with us, who's going to be listening to who and who's not going to be listening to who, and who's going to step on who and who's going to run all over who. And all I know is there's going to be, you know, lots of voices and sousaphones and trombones and trumpets and drums and you know, it just should be really fun and just a lot of fun, interacting, improvisational spontaneity. I know that the last we did an experiment, you know, like a rehearsal, what would happen, and David and I performed with a psychedelic rock band, the Rabbles, and I ended up screaming, and the music was just going loud, and people got up and they started dancing. And this is during the poetry, and they were dancing and the band's going and everybody's having a good time. And then when it was David's turn, I think David realized that there was something else in the air and what he was going to do. And he just abandoned his text entirely and started singing spontaneously words that he made up at the moment. And everybody was on the floor. I mean, they were just, he was beautiful. And that was, he just took it to another level, and that was nowhere written in the program that was going to. So I think that what we're going to see is each place, it will be a happening.
A happening. That's a word I haven't heard in a while. So when you get back to the San Francisco Bay Area, what's going to happen? What will be the culmination of Rock Pile?
When we get back from this trip, hopefully we'll still be talking to each other. I'm sure we will be, and it's going to be, we're going to have learned a lot. I mean, performing with all these different great musicians in all these different situations is going to be a real test for me, at least, to how to read with a musician and how to be spontaneous and how to improvise. And so that, and meeting these musicians, we're going to get back to the Bay Area, and we're going to be looking for a venue to do the grand finale performance. And we'll be working with local musicians from the Bay Area, as we have done in every city. But I'm thinking I would love to have some of the musicians we met on the road come out and join us and take that information that we gathered while traveling and bringing it and sharing it with the local, with our family and friends here in the Bay Area.
Okay, thank you, Michael Rothenberg and Terry Carrion. The dates again for Rockpile, their first gig is on October 8th in Los Angeles at the Hammer Museum, and it continues through the month of November. To check out the complete schedule of Rockpile, you can go to bigbridge.org/rockpile. This is an interactive site.
Luna breaks through these pages and winds up, propped up, hooked to the brass frame bed's back grill, swaying back and forth. Stares at the wall my shadow moves over. Back and forth I pace, grumbling my poems. Lion roaring poem, boiling water poem, dragon explosion poem. The window rattles, what does glass know? My poems are gardens from my mouth, like ivy out of Botticelli's teenage seashell brides. Luna's an eagle. Flutters her wings, gold coins splash on the rug. I see her nerve map light up like a marvelous pinball machine, celebrating total, non-tilt victory forever.
And you just heard one of the troubadours, poets, musicians from Rockpile, David Meltzer. This is from an older CD of his called Green Morning, and he just performed Luna Time, number 2.
Home's that place somewhere you go each day to see your wife, yeah, to see your wife. Oh, talk to me some more, you know that you don't have to go. You're the poetry man, you make things all right, yeah. You make things all right.
All right, everybody knows that was Phoebe Snow singing Poetry Man. Up next, Robert Creeley reads En Famille.
En Famille. I wandered lonely as a cloud. I'd seemingly lost the crowd I'd come with, family. Father, mother, sister, and brothers, fact of a common blood. Now there was no one, just my face in the mirror, coat on a single hook, a bed I could make getting out of. Where had they gone? What was that vague determination, cut off the nurturing relation with all the density, this given company? What made one feel such desperation? To get away, get far from home, be gone from those would know us even if they only saw our noses or our toes, accept with joy our helpless mess, taking for granted it was part of us. My friends, hands on each other's shoulders, holding on, keeping the pledge, to be for one, for all, a securing center, no matter up or down or right or left. To keep the faith, keep happy, keep together, keep at it, so keep on, despite the fact of necessary drift. Home might be still the happiest place on earth. You won't get far by yourself. It's dark out there. There's a long way to go. The dog knows. It's him loves us most, or seems to, in dark nights of the soul. Keep a tight hold, steady, we're not lost. Despite the sad vagaries, anchored in love, placed in the circle, young and old, around, love's fact of this bond. One day one will look back and think of them, where they were, now gone. Remember it all. Turning inside as if in dream, the twisting face I want to be my own. The people loved and with me still. I see their painful faith. Grow, dears, then fly away. But when the dark comes, then come home. Lights in the window, heart stays true. Call, and I'll come to you. The wind blows through the shifting trees. Outside the window, over the fields below, emblems of growth, of older, younger, of towering size are all the vulnerable hope, as echoes in the image of these three, look out with such reflective pleasure, so various and close. They stand there, waiting to hear a music they will know. I like the way you both look out at me. Somehow it's sometimes hard to be a human. Arms and legs get often in the way, making oneself a bulky, awkward burden. Tell me your happiness is simply true. Tell me I can still learn to be like you. Tell me the truth is what we do. Tell me that care for one another is the clue. We're here because there's nowhere else to go. We've come in faith, we learned as with all else. Someone once told us, and so it is we know. No one is left outside such simple place. No one's too late, no one can be too soon. We comfort one another, making room. We dream of heaven as a climbing stair. We look at stars and wonder why and where. Have we told you all you'd thought to know? Is it really so quickly now the time to go? Has anything happened you will not forget? Is where you are enough for all to share? Is wisdom just an empty word? Is age a time one might finally well have missed? Must humanness be its own reward? Is happiness this?
That was Robert Creeley. Before signing off tonight, I want to inform you of two events coming up during this beautiful month of October that I hope you'll be able to attend. The first event is taking place on Thursday, October 22nd at 7 p.m. at Trattoria Cattaneo, a wonderful little Italian restaurant at 2700 Guadalupe Avenue in Santa Rosa, right across the street from Safeway. Diane Hales, author of La Bella Lingua, My Love Affair with Italian, the world's most enchanting language, will be there to read from and talk about her book. This is a celebration of not only the language of Italy, but the culture of Italy, through its history, music, art, literature, poetry, movies, and yes, food. That's at Trattoria Cattaneo, 2700 Guadalupe Avenue, on Thursday, October 22nd at 7 p.m. Appearing with Diane Hales will be Sebastopol poet Nancy Cavers Doherty, reading from her collection Levittown, a small book of poems inspired by her visit to post-Katrina New Orleans. I'll be introducing both Hales and Doherty and would love to see you there. I do recommend that you call Trattoria Cattaneo to make reservations. Their number is 542-9050. 542-9050. If you would like more information about this event, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Then, on Friday, October 30th at 7 p.m., the Word Temple Poetry Series returns to the Sonoma County Museum. I'll be introducing Michigan poet Chad Sweeney, author of three books of poetry, including Arranging the Blaze, published by Anhinga Press, and Thomas Santolella, also the author of three books of poems, including Lights and Mysteries, published by Copper Canyon Press. That's Friday, October 30th at 7 p.m. at the Sonoma County Museum, 425 7th Street, Santa Rosa, directly across the street from the parking garage for the Santa Rosa Plaza. And right now, last but not least for tonight's show on Word Temple, Arissa White is going to perform her poem, Saratoga Avenue, with the Jessica Jones Quartet. This is from their CD, Word, the Jessica Jones Quartet, featuring Candace Jones. Also on the CD are Lou Grassi, Tony Jones, Jessica Jones, and Dana Stevens. Here now is Arissa White performing Saratoga Avenue. This is Catherine Hastings. As always, thanks for listening.
You smell like Saratoga Avenue. Morning comes with no police sirens. The sun escapes entanglement from the how do I begin tragedies of project buildings. The sunlight cuts the curtains, a machete in bone. We lay like sky and water. Your sleeping face betrayed by a smile uncovers the moon in your teeth. I fall back to sleep dreaming hurricane kisses, monsoon tongue. You smell like Saratoga Avenue when the night wipes away the afternoon sweat with a rag. A breeze like rubbing alcohol comes quick and cool. The train only makes your body tremble. Love feels like chewing on rocks. Quiet doesn't stay, and you can't hear the heart's rhythms before your left nipple sucks it up. You smell like Saratoga Avenue when Heineken kisses make you dance on invisible waves. Severs the chords of your adagio breathing. In a syringe, the symphony concludes. The virus slips you into vertigo. Like rain clouds, the concrete looks for the sun you wait at the corner. You smell smelled like Saratoga Avenue when words wet with old English converge at the corner. Brothers weave worries into hip-hop. He steps out the streetlight with the light skin and wavy hair your mama likes. Persuasively spins his game around you to custom fit like the leather jacket you always wanted. You ride his hip, a 45. He aims, fires, and creates wounds. Plunders the openings and leaves you a bullet-pierced sky, barely breathing in your project box. You smell like Saratoga Avenue's beaten sidewalks. When dreams are forsaken and prayer stains your hands, where women find wings from bedsheets, envisions freedom with the eyes of suicide. Men bleed like unfertilized eggs while the moon completes its own cycle. Wailing walls are called till death, and there's no time to write letters to God.